The Hamilton Horton, December 18th, 1973, Winston-Salem.
So it's a period essentially from 1948 to 1970.
Not for attribution without permission.
Can we start with the role of organized religion in North Carolina?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
A lot of people attribute the victory on liquor by the drink to the strength of organized Protestant evangelical groups. Can you comment on the role of them in North Carolina politics?
As today, you know, precise involvement in politics, favoring, you know, particular people or candidates, I don't think they do much of that. It'd be unwise if they were to try. But the kind of churches we have a great deal to do with the kind of attitudes we have and the kind of people, and this is historic. Back in the time of the Revolution, practically every Anglican priest jumped ship and ran with the king and his people. So at the end of the Revolution, we only had just a handful of Anglican priests. And it was into this vacuum that your Baptists and your Methodists moved in great force. So we have never had, since the Revolution, the presence of the Episcopal tradition, so to speak, in large numbers. Now, it's had influence out of proportion of its numbers. But the vast bulk of our people, by default, have been Baptist, Methodist, a number of holiness, in any event, the more unstructured Protestant kinds of churches. And almost invariably, these were churches that were out of the mainstream of ancient Christianity. They would oppose card playing, dancing, liquor, anything that seemed the slightest bit fun. And this is colored. Our attitudes toward liquor come from the fact that most of our people are brought up from this kind of church background. Now, it probably also has something to do with this sort of maybe, I don't think we're more pious than anybody else. I'm sure of that. But there are some very definite church constraints. You know, you're supposed to go to church, and you're supposed to go to Sunday school on Sunday in this state. It's expected of you. It is socially almost required. You don't find this many other places. Now, the strength of it, of the Protestant tradition, and by this I mean the Methodists and Baptists, you know, the people who came from the New Awakening, the John Wesley bunch and so on, would be around the Piedmont and the Mountmont. Presbyterians, Cross Creek Settlement, Cumberland County, a lot of them. You've got Lutherans in Rowan County, on up into here, of course, Moravians here, but except for these little enclaves, it's essentially pietistic, old-fashioned, Bible-belt Christian.
How does it affect contemporary statewide candidacies? I mean, what does a candidate have to take? How does he have to deal with this? Does he deal with the leaders of the churches, or just deal with the ethos?
Gosh, I don't know. I can't imagine, you know, trying to get a church engulfed with it. It may be done, but I've never heard of it.
You get Billy Graham endorsements, don't you?
I never have.
Well, I don't mean you but, personally, but I mean candidates. When he invites Speaker Bowles and Lindsey Helm to come play golf with him before the election, doesn't that have the effect of an endorsement? Isn't that how it's seen?
I just don't know about that. And, of course, that's something really beyond my ken. Now, they will get definitely involved in your liquor issue. But it's very hard to get them involved in some of these other issues like abortion and capital punishment and things that you would think really spoke a little more to religion. I mean, it's some of them are, it's a one-issue church. Look up.
That's it?
Yeah.
This,
thank you. This little bunch run by, what's the name? What's the fellow's name in Raleigh? Who opposed liquor by the drink? You ran that thing.
Privet?
Lobbyist, yeah, Coy Privet. His bunch endorsed for the General Assembly in Brunswick County. A guy who, as I understand it, was a pretty thoroughgoing lush. And the fellow running against him was a member of the vestry of the local Episcopal Church. But Coy's bunch pushed the lush because he said he was going to vote against liquor by the drink. I mean, how really narrow can you get?
Jack went to a conference in Atlanta 2 weekends ago, the Southern Republican Conference. Maybe he can better articulate this than I, but came out with a feeling that essentially what you're looking at when you look at the Republican Party of the Southern states are conservative coalitions that reach out and pull in maybe moderate blocks to help them win elections. Holzhauser, on the other hand, sees it differently. Sees the Republican Party then made a sense of being a moderate kind of a party, which pulls in the conservative blocks to win the election. Could you comment on the way you see the North Carolina Republican Party as compared with the others?
Well, there's an element of truth in both, but I would guess that probably we are more conservative than the Democratic Party, certainly the party anarchy is more conservative than the Democratic Party. There may be sections of the party that are different, you know, different areas of the state. And I think that Jim Holzhauser would probably fall into a more liberal wing of the Republican Party, but you know, compared to Democrats, that's conservative.
What does conservative mean to you, political terms in North Carolina?
Well, not just in North Carolina, if you don't mind, Jack. I define conservatism as sort of a concern for the continuity of institutions, of civilization. A habit of mind that puts the burden of proof on the person who espouses something new, something different, who makes a presumption in favor of the way things are until that someone carries that burden through. Now, conservatives can take, you know, the same issue and be on both sides with different people, conscientiously. There's no system of conservative thought that I know of. It's mainly a bent of mind. North Carolina.
I mean, you have a conservative and a liberal looking at the same issue, come to the same conclusion, but
that's
by
right.
Different routes.
That's right.
So that's basically true.
I think so.
But don't you run into a paradox in that conservatives today, both the national and state level, are essentially conserving what the liberals built in terms of government. Governmental programs.
You understand what I'm getting at?
Right, I'm trying to think of a program that that you might apply that to. Social Security, perhaps. I think that's unnecessarily putting a program emphasis on it. The conservative is just about as concerned as anybody, you know, that no one go hungry or sick. I think he would prefer that it be handled on a local, more tradition-oriented basis. But he would favor the end result that no one go hungry. I don't think he would necessarily espouse Social Security, for example, normally. But once he's got it, I think you'll try to make it work better. We differ a little bit from the English Conservative Party. They just maintain that they're better managers, I gather. Not much doctrine left there, is there? I don't think so.
B.O. Key's book, said that North Carolina was a more progressive state, stood out from the rest of the South. Treatment and race relations, providing government services, so forth. 25 years later, North Carolina's relative position in such things, such indicators as per capita income, doctor to population ratio, other indices of related indices, has not changed. One, do you think Key was wrong? And if not, does North Carolina change?
Well, I've always had the feeling, Jack, that we were done more harm than good by being called the most progressive southern state, you know, because we've been trading on that for too damn long. Pat ourselves in the back. We like to think of Chapel Hill as the Athens of the South. You know, you've heard these phrases. And we use that as an excuse for going along the same way. Meanwhile, South Carolina, which I think in many ways is more progressive than we, has far surpassed us in such things as energy, as industry acquisition. Virginia in a number of ways. I don't think that our leadership has been especially imaginative or strong in trying to address our problem. You know, we just keep saying over and over we're the most progressive southern state and then don't do anything progressive. We're just now getting to the point where we're a little more selective in our industry acquisition. South Carolina did that some time ago. South Carolina had their Efficiency Study Commission back under Governor 10 years ago. Jack, who was there?
Collins.
What did brought those folks in from outside the state? Dun and Bradstreet sticks my mind, but I don't know what they...
Oh, Bob McNair.
Yeah, yeah. And their government was streamlined long before that. Virginia is...
It was Moody's Investment Service.
Mm-hmm. That's it. And they did a good job. We were sitting up here with a sort of an antiquated old one-horse shay. So we aren't really that much more progressive. Now, we are ahead of them in some respects. But almost invariably, these are the things that are the product of an extremely dedicated and patriotic small number of people. And that'd be in the University at Chapel Hill, I would say, is outstanding in a number of respects. And in the higher levels of the arts, for example. I think our handling of the Arts Society, the
art, the school of the arts, the governor's school, all these things that are more elitist, if you will, oriented, we are ahead of. And almost invariably, they are the results of just a gaggle of people who really give a happy damn, and they're in their work.
What about race relations? North Carolina was supposed to be one of the leaders in the South in that field. Yet, if you look at the 1972 election, the Wallace victory, you might wonder. Really on the test of that, first test of that, the last test was in 1960, I guess, in the I Beverly Lake and Terry Sanford race, and it hasn't been tested since until 72.
I think that people are taking out a lot of resentments on by voting for Wallace, not just racial resentments. But, you know, after all, what do you consider good race relations? Don't most of us really think of good race relations when the colored person stays at home and stays quiet? That's a pretty pretty sorry definition, because by that you'd have excellent race relations in a slave society, wouldn't you?
This is the absence of a problem.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's figure my hometown. See you later. Bye-bye.
We probably have been more willing to accept integration in stride. But that was a function of our leadership, but not of our rank and file. Your rank and file in North Carolina is pretty... typical Southerner. Prejudice the same way as my grandfather was.
Staff being more input
in that. Is there a movement of conservative Democrats under the Republican Party? Is it the kind of conservative that you were describing, some of those men of mine, or is it
you're getting
another
both,
kind?
You're getting both kinds, Walter. You're getting some who are real kooks. I mean, you know, John Bircher types. You're getting others who have always wanted to move into the Republican Party because they felt a little more at home there, but there was no advantage to them because the party wasn't a viable force. You've got others who are really fairly intellectually grounded conservatives who just feel this is probably the best chance for influencing a political party. All stripes. It is not any sort of a pandemonium. I don't see, you know, great waves of people moving over. But it's been going on for, let's see, since 1948, when I began keeping some sort of notes. And it's increased and kept increasing, and it's been steady, up and down. When whether the Democrats were winning nationally or the Republicans, your movement in North Carolina to the Republican Party has been steady.
In Atlanta, 2 weeks ago, there was a lot of talk about realignment. Do you see a basic political realignment shaping up in North Carolina or in the South?
You mean conservative liberal?
I suppose.
Isn't that what they mean by realignment?
I think so. It always has a surface appeal, but I think it'd be a bad thing for the country. I'm inclined to think that your Anglo-Saxon countries have been able to govern themselves without revolutions and this kind of thing, and have pretty stable governments
because they've got basically two-party systems, and you can only have a two-party system where the reins of power are handed over to the other without incident if both parties are broad enough so that neither is the Antichrist, if you will. In other words, if you've got two fairly broadly based parties, with liberals and conservatives in each, with people having friends on both sides of the battle lines, then the parties can transfer power, knowing that nothing cataclysmic is really going to take place. If your parties get doctrinaire, get 180 degrees opposed to each other, then it's going to be more and more difficult to effect a smooth transfer of power. That's your problem in South America, it seems to me, and in your Latin tradition countries. They're very cerebral about their politics.
Are you arguing that both parties ought to maintain conservative and liberal wings?
Uh-huh. I think that's what they will do.
George Reedy described in his book, The Power of the Press, the two political, the Democratic Party being basically a party in the middle that has problems with its kooks on the left, and the Republican Party is being basically a party in the middle that has problems with its kooks on the right.
I think that's a pretty good way of putting it.
Well, do you see that?
We don't have any left-wing kooks. But the main thing is that both of them are parties of the center. This one perhaps a shade to the right, this one a shade to the left, but basically centrist.
Well, do you see that being the direction of change in the South and in North Carolina? Or do you see North Carolina being in the same boat as the rest of the South? Because both of those seem to be more in that direction. And the rest of the Republicans were more radical sort of realignment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jim, of course, isn't going to be there forever. And every day that passes, his strength wanes. This is because it happens to every governor. You know, he can't succeed himself, and it won't be long before people begin looking, you know, whose bandwagon are they going to jump on next. The long-range thing, as I see it, is that North Carolina is going to turn into a two-party state. And both parties are going to move to the left. And that's because when you... each party is going to have to find its votes in places that it wished it didn't have. And they're both going to go courting. And that's going to be from labor and from class. And so you get into a promising match, and the party that out-promises the other gets the vote. Move a little further.
How much will performance mean in addition to promise?
I think they're getting a little more savvy now. Labor, for example, all they wanted used to be if you just leave the door open and let them talk. Didn't expect any great things. Now they've got good organization, they know where they want to go, they're well-led, there's a creative sense of militancy there, and you can't patronize labor anymore.
Who's the best labor spokesman in North Carolina?
Hillary.
The only person who's really doing much speaking is Wilbur Harvey now. He has some trouble with his own people. But
that's what led to the question. Mm-hmm.
But there's nobody else doing it.
Do they have somebody? Is there somebody in labor who's working effectively without making much noise? You know, who's setting up these organizations?
What organizations?
Well, you said they're better organized.
Right. I don't know whether there's anyone who is, you know, delegated to do this. I do know here we have a central labor union.
Charles Brooks is the political activist. Incidentally, he's a former member of the Democratic State Executive Committee who shifted his registration to Republican. And is a very, very strong member of the party. Delegate to the convention last time. He would probably know more than anybody else.
You know what kind of relationship he had with Hobby?
Doesn't like him. We were. Our people from this area were pretty upset with Hobby.
So you think Holzhaus is moving in the right basic direction for development of the party?
Mm-mm. No. This is going to sound inconsistent, but and I sometimes am inconsistent because I've, you know, as a conservative, I want to see that prevail. As a Republican, I want to see that prevail. Sometimes they aren't on the same path. I think that he is moving to the left. He feels that that the place to get the margin of difference for statewide elections is in your minority votes, your blacks or your unions or whatever, the blocks. My feeling is that these blocks are, by their very nature, pretty fickle, and they aren't loyal to anybody. So they aren't going to be good Republicans in the sense of your mainstream bunch. They'll stay with us just as long as we out-promise the Democrats and outperform them. But when the time comes that they out-promise us, then they're going to be moving off again. So you're getting converts down with ever-increasing appetites. The other alternative would be to move to the right, and the only basic stomping ground there is to organize the Democratic East. And this is basically a fairly conservative, agrarian, rooted area of the state. They are sort of our cup of tea, so long as we stay more conservative than Democrats. They'd be more likely, in my view, to be stable, loyal Republicans over the long pull, say, in terms of 50 years or so.
But based on ideology and not program?
Yeah.
Are you saying in one hand that the two blocks you mentioned?
They're fickle and they aren't going to be loyal.
Well, they're going to be oriented, program-oriented in the sense that whoever can promise most can get their vote. But what you're looking for are people with ideological or philosophical commitment to the party.
You see the difference
is
this.
The East?
We can move that way because I believe it's fairly well conceded that the Republicans are a little to the right of the Democrats anyway. So as long as we stay to the right of the Democrats, this is going to be more naturally the party of these people in the East than the Democratic Party is.
All right, and many. Okay, but how do you go about attracting them? What basis do you attract the people? Like Jesse did? Which is essentially an ideological kind of thing?
And
did you read it that way?
Well, there's a lot of good old let's mix it up fun attitude down east. They love Jesse because he'll give them hell. He speaks for a lot of their concerns, their kinds. They've heard him for a long time, and he's always told it like it was, you hear him say over and over. That's one way you can go. Another way, and we've done this, is simply go into a town and organize it for the Republican Party. Send some expert people in there, get a good slate, and the next thing you know, you'll begin winning elections. We've done this in Johnston County, we've done it in a number of counties now. We've got little
pockmarks of influence all over. Goldsboro, Henderson, Republicans being elected. They need some help from the state headquarters to, you know, teach them how, get some expert assistance in there in terms of media and all this, and you can push them over. Then you begin building your party.
What kind of candidates are they going to be recruiting like that to elect?
Well, let's face it, on your local level, most of the issues are not ideological. I mean, there's no Democratic way of laying a sewer line or a Republican way of laying a sewer line. What you're doing there is building a party from the local level on up.
But thinking about the state legislature, what kind of philosophy do you want these candidates to have, or don't you pick them on that basis? Is it just a matter of picking who can win?
Yeah, a lot of it is that. A lot of it is that. And it's unfortunate, but we don't have that many to pick from. See, we are still horribly undermanned in terms of registration. And we can only pick candidates from our registration. Even worse is the fact that we have an even smaller percentage of those people who normally would be expected to run. The percentage of lawyers, for example, who are Republicans, I believe, is probably much less than the percentage of Republicans to Democrats in the state at large. And this is Democrats have been very careful about this. No Republican lawyer ever searched a highway title or did a single thing for the state or any Democratic government. And so there were pressures. If you want to be a judge, you've got to be a Democrat. If you want to do anything in government, and lawyers are dealing with laws and government all the time, you had to be a Democrat. And so, little by little, lots of normal Republican families became Democrats if they were lawyers. And so, we've got a scarcity of talent, as well as a scarcity of people. And so we simply haven't got a lot of people to choose from. So lots of times, even in Republican areas like the mountains, you've got a good, strong rank and file, but you have a hard time finding the candidate, the man who can afford to run, who's willing to.
The situation has now changed in that you have a Republican governor mm-hmm. who has a long tradition and record of basic party building.
Yeah.
Came up through the ranks of the party and he has picked his own party chairman. Mm-hmm. Is the success or failure of the Hozell administration in building a Republican Party in addition to its role in governing going to be a crucial determining factor in the future Republican Party of North Carolina?
I certainly think that it will have a real influence on it. But the Republican Party is here. It's going to stay here. Even if Jim muffs it badly, there'll be a lot of people ready to pick up the pieces. We aren't at the point, you see, like perhaps some other southern states where it's still a very, very thin little structure, like perhaps in South Carolina, with Thurman being the one man who holds it together, isn't he? Pretty much. We've had an indigenous party that goes back into Reconstruction time. Yeah.
Two schools of thought on that. There's some feeling that the reason Thurman switched was because you had a structure there to switch to.
But that may be.
64.
I'd heard it the other way, and I may be very well be wrong, but I think we've got a party that's going to stick around. And I think Jim can help it a lot if he doesn't also succumb to the temptation of building a personal a group of people who are personally loyal to him. In other words, a little party within a big party. And that's the tendency that his people who surround him most closely are always going to have. And I think this is probably true of every major office holder. The closest people to him want to restrict him to nothing but the true believers. That means someone who goes down the line with them all the time.
and perpetuate themselves.
That's right. That's right. And if this happens, and translated into North Carolina politics, this means if Holt's House's administration does not make some move to embrace the people who supported Frank Rouse and so forth, and principally they're in the East, I think he's going to have some difficult times. I don't think it's going to be as helpful to the party. If he's really interested in building the party, and I believe he is, he will want to build that party for all Republicans and not just for those of his particular ilk who agree with him 100% of the time. And
do you think he made a strategic mistake or not in fighting Rouse?
Oh, I do. I told him that. But he had made up his mind to do it. And at one point, he didn't think he was going to oppose him. But I think that he got some bad advice from somebody else. I thought that his being in the governorship and Rouse being in the chairmanship encompassed the whole spectrum so thoroughly that if they could simply find some way to work together, that it'd be an unbeatable combination.
Was there no attempt to work together?
Jim could work with
Frank. Did something happen that
Frank could work with Jim, but Gene Anderson and Frank Rouse were like all in one. Frank despised him with a passion, and Anderson reciprocated.
So the relationship between the two was never really tested as to whether or not they could work together.
Jim and Frank, that's right. The trouble was, you see, that Jim, that Gene Anderson was more important to Jim Holt's House than Frank Rouse was, for obvious reasons.
But the decision then to depose Rouse was based not on Rouse's support of Gardner, but on Rouse and Anderson's inability to get along.
I think that's largely part of it.
What do you think that fight is going to do to the party in terms of the 74 election and the 76 election? Is it going to have any consequences?
It can. Heaven knows if there is ever a time when we really ought to be pulling together. It's now. And I don't know whether it will yet. We'll begin to know when we begin to see whether there's any attempt on the part of the party, or directly or indirectly, or anybody, to think to purge or to oppose members of the General Assembly who supported Rouse. If we get into that sort of luxury, then, you know, that means our efforts are being dissipated, killing each other instead of Democrats.
What do you think Bennett's going to do as party chairman insofar as building a party structure?
Very little. But you see, he's not supposed to do much. He's essentially a caretaker. When the party has the governorship, most of these things, there's no need for him to be the symbol of the party, the governor.
Well, is there a party executive director in this?
Yes. And, just thought you might ask that, and I just learned it today, so here it is. Grady Franklin is executive director. He's from Rutherford County. And your legislative campaign director is Bill Russell. Faye Madigan is finance director, and Bobby Moss is secretary. So, you've got a staff of 1, 2, 3, 4. In addition to Bennett, Bennett is a lawyer. He's going to spend most of his time practicing law. He just can't afford a full-time job. But you don't need it, you see, when you've got these people to handle your details and Holt's House to handle the House Silhouette stuff.
Well, do you see them following along the direction you think the party should do from the standpoint of going into an area and organizing it?
I don't know. They haven't been in long enough. I think that the big push right now is going to be finding legislative candidates.
Is that going to be easier to find if we have President Ford and President Nixon, or that matter?
I don't know. It's going to be hard for both parties to find. I think I don't know of a single politician who doesn't feel a little bit disgusted. I mean, just a general malaise about politics. Tired, feel it slightly pointless, wonder whether it's really worth it all, you know, that just this malaise that has percolated down to our level. You try your best to whip them up into the same enthusiasm that they had, say, 10 months ago, and it's hard.
Thinking back over the 25-year period and all those administrations, starting with Carter Scott, which of those administrations do you think were the most significant and why? Do one or two of them, three of them stand out as more important? The state then.
All right, starting with who?
1948, Carter Scott.
All right. I think the best governor we had was probably Terry Sanford. He surrounded himself with good, quick, intellectually alert people, and put out some excellent programs that are still being continued. I think he had a good administration. And left office so unpopular that he probably still can't be elected anything.
Why?
I don't if I know.
Is it because of the food crisis?
I think that had a lot to do with it. But it's a sad thing, because of all people who really wanted to be liked, you know, Sanford was one of them. Desperately wanted to be liked and approved.
One theory we hear is that the state went through so much social change in that 4-year period that it was ready for two or three caretaker administrations.
Well, it may take one, but never two or three caretaker administrations. But what we haven't had since then is any administration that really had much imagination to it. We all know that the normal standard problems of government of North Carolina has. But what have we offered new in terms of approaching it? Very little.
Can you say the same thing about Holzhauser's administration?
Well, it's young yet. Some of the things that he's done, I think, are excellent PR. And if he pushes them and really uses them as they should be, they can be good for the government as a long-term thing. One of them is an ombudsman I've been talking to about for a long time. The Governor's Efficiency Study Commission is another thing that, if we push it on through, we'll save us some $66 million. I rather like that. I like the idea of hotlines into the state government offices. But so far as any, you know, creative really catching program, I think that's all there is.
Yeah, right? I'm not talking about the style in which they did things or doing things, but the program content.
I don't think we've gotten a special program content any different from what we've had in the past.
You think that will change?
Imperceptibly, because some of your administrators and the governors very much in favor of this are pretty good themselves about it. For example, the direction of the natural economic resources in their theory of location and acquisition of parks and recreation areas has completely changed. The Highway Commission has been restructured. They're thinking now in terms of a 7-year program. Now, whether this is going to work, we don't know yet. So it's just it's a little premature to say something dire. We haven't been able to make any improvement on the ABC system. There's just
how about
not much program content.
Jack, we better get up to see Bill Leibrook. Yeah. We have a 2 o'clock appointment.
Okay.
How about industrial development?
We are still pushing on that. Jack, do you deduct this from the royalties?
The royalties. That's the best.
End interview with Ham Horton.